We looked at each other, winked, then closed our eyes and went back to sleep. Compared to the month's worth of explosions and shit we'd just lived through, this was nothing. While I'd been in Iraq, my platoon was sent to the Philippines on a mission to train up the local military to fight radical terrorists. It wasn't exactly the most exciting assignment. Finally, with that mission complete, they were sent to Baghdad. I went out with some other SEALs to the airport to greet them. I was expecting a big welcome. Here my family was finally coming in. They came off the plane cussing me. "Hey, asshole." And much worse than that. Like everything else they do, SEALs excel at foul language. "Jealousy, thy name is SEAL." I'd wondered why I hadn't heard anything from them over the past few months. In fact, I was wondering why they were jealous. As far as I knew, they hadn't heard about anything I'd been doing. Come to find out, my chief had been regaling them with the after-action reports of my sniping in Fallujah. They'd been sitting around hand-holding the Filipinos and hating life while I'd been having all the fun. They got over it. Eventually, they even asked me to do a little presentation on what I'd done, complete with pointers and stuff. One more chance to use PowerPoint. Fun with the big shots. Now that they were here, I joined them and started doing some DAs. Intel would find an IED maker, or maybe a financier, give us the intel, and we'd go in and snag him. We'd hit him very early in the morning, blow his door down, rush inside, and take him before he even had a chance to get out of bed. This went on for about a month. By now, DAs were pretty much an old routine. They were a hell of a lot less dangerous in Baghdad than in Fallujah. We were living out near Biap, Baghdad International Airport, and working from there. One day my chief came over and gave me a chiefly grin. "You've got to have some fun, Chris," he told me. "You need to do a little PSD. He was using SEAL sarcasm. PSD stands for Personal Security Detail, Bodyguard Duty. The platoon had been assigned to provide security for high-ranking Iraqi officials. The insurgents had started kidnapping them, trying to disrupt the government. It was a pretty thankless job. So far, I'd been able to avoid it, but it seemed my ninja smoke had run out. I left and went over to the other side of the city in the Green Zone. The Green Zone was a section of central Baghdad that was created as a safe area for the Allies and the new Iraqi government. It was physically cut off from the rest of the city by cement walls and barbed wire. There were only a few ways in and out, and these were under strict control. The U.S. and other Allied embassies were located there, as were Iraqi government buildings. I lasted an entire week. The Iraqi officials, so-called, were notorious for not telling their escorts what their schedules were or giving details on who was supposed to be traveling with them. Given the level of security in the Green Zone, that was a significant problem. I acted as advance. That meant I would go ahead of an official convoy, make sure the route was safe, and then stand at the security checkpoint and ID the convoy vehicles as they came through. This way, the Iraqi vehicles could move through the checkpoints quickly without becoming targets. One day I was advanced for a convoy that included the Iraqi vice president. I'd already checked the route and arrived at a Marine checkpoint outside the airport. Baghdad International was on the other side of the city from the Green Zone. While the grounds themselves were secure, the area around it and the highway leading to the gate still came under occasional fire. It was a prime terror target, since the insurgents could pretty much figure that anyone going in or out was related to the Americans or the new Iraqi government in some way. I was on radio comms with one of my boys in the convoy. He gave me the details on who was in the group, how many vehicles we had, and the like. He also told me that we had an Army Hummer in the front and an Army Hummer in the back, simple markers I could pass along to the guards. The convoy came flying up, Hummer in the lead. We counted off the vehicles, and lo, there was the last Hummer taking up the rear. All good. All of a sudden, two more vehicles appeared behind them in hot pursuit. The Marines looked at me. "Those two are not mine," I told them. "What do you want us to do?" "Pull your Hummer out and train that 50 on him," I yelled, pulling up my M4. I jumped out in the roadway, gun raised, hoping that would get their attention. They didn't stop. Behind me, the Hummer had pulled up and the gunner was locked and loaded. Still unsure whether I was dealing with a kidnapping or just some stray vehicles, I fired a warning shot. The cars veered off and hauled ass the other way. Thwarted kidnapping? Suicide bombers who'd lost their nerve? No, come to find out, these were two friends of the vice president. He'd forgotten to tell us about them. He wasn't too pleased. My command wasn't too pleased either. I got fired from my PSD job, which wouldn't have been all that bad except that I then had to spend the next week sitting in the green zone doing nothing. My platoon leadership tried to get me back for some DAs, but the headshed had decided to stick it to me a bit and kept me twiddling my thumbs. That is the worst possible torture for a SEAL, missing out on the action. Luckily, they didn't hang on to me for too long. Haifa Street. In December 2005, Iraq geared up for national elections, its first since the fall of Saddam, and the first free and fair ones the country had ever held. The insurgency was doing everything it could to stop them. Election officials were being kidnapped left and right. Others were executed in the streets. Talk about your negative campaigning. Haifa Street in Baghdad was a particularly dangerous place. After three election officials were killed there, the army put together a plan to protect officials in the area. The strategy called for snipers to do overwatches. I was a sniper. I was available. I didn't even have to raise my hand. I joined an army unit from the Arkansas National Guard, a great bunch of good old boys, warriors all. People who are used to the traditional separation between the different military branches may think it's unusual for a SEAL to be working with the Army, or even the Marines for that matter, but the forces were often well integrated during my time in Iraq. Any unit could put in an RFF, request for forces. That request would get filled by whatever service was available, so if a unit needed snipers, as they did in this case, whatever branch had available snipers would ship them over. There's always back and forth between sailors, soldiers, and Marines, but I saw a lot of respect between the different branches, at least during the fighting. I certainly found most of the Marines and soldiers I worked with to be top-notch. You had your exceptions, but then you have your exceptions in the Navy, too. The first day I reported for my new assignment, I thought I'd need an interpreter. Some people like to harass me about my Texas twang, but these hillbillies? Holy shit! The important information came from the senior enlisted and the officers who spoke regular English, but the privates and junior guys straight out of the backwoods could have been talking Chinese for all I knew. We started working on Haifa Street right near where the three election officials had been killed. The National Guard would secure an apartment building to use as a hide. Then I'd go in, pick out an apartment, and set up. Haifa Street was not exactly Hollywood Boulevard, though it was the place to be if you were a bad guy. The street ran about 2 miles from Assassin's Gate at the end of the Green Zone up to the northwest. It was the scene of numerous firefights and gun battles, all sorts of IED attacks, kidnappings, assassinations, you name it, and it happened on Haifa. American soldiers dubbed it Purple Heart Boulevard. The buildings we used for overwatches were 15 to 16 stories tall and had a commanding view of the road. We moved around to the extent that we could, shifting locations to keep the insurgents off balance. There were an untold number of hideouts in the squat buildings beyond the immediate highway, all up and down the street. The bad guys didn't have much of a commute to get to work. The insurgents here were a real mix. Some were Mujahideen, former Ba'ath or Iraqi army guys. Others were loyal to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or Sadr, or some other of the wackadoos out there. At the start, they'd wear black or sometimes these green sashes, but once they realized that set them apart, they resorted to wearing regular civilian clothes just like everyone else. They wanted to mix with civilians to make it more difficult for us to figure out who they were. They were cowards who not only would hide behind women and children, but probably hoped we'd kill the women and children since in their minds it helped their cause by making us look bad. One afternoon I watched a young teenage kid waiting for the bus below me. When the bus pulled up, a group of older teenagers and young adults got off. All of a sudden, the kid I was watching turned and started walking very quickly in the opposite direction. The group caught up quickly. One of them pulled out a pistol and put his arm around the kid's neck. As soon as he did that, I started shooting. The kid I was protecting took off. I got two or three of his would-be kidnappers. The others got away. The sons of the election officials were a favorite target. The insurgents would use the families to put pressure on the officials to drop out, or else they'd just kill the family members as a warning to others not to help the government hold the elections or even vote. The salacious and the surreal. One evening, we took over what we thought was an abandoned apartment, since it was empty when we arrived. I was rotating with another sniper, and while I was off, I went hunting around to see if there was something I might use to make the hide more comfortable. In an open drawer of a bureau, I saw all this sexy lingerie, crotchless panties, nightgowns, very suggestive stuff. Not my size, though. There was often an odd, almost surreal mix of things inside the buildings, items that would seem out of place under the best circumstances, like the car tires we found on the roof in Fallujah, or the goat we found in the bathroom of a Haifa Street apartment. I'd see something, then spend the rest of the day wondering what the story was. After a while, the bizarre came to seem natural. Not quite surprising were the TVs and satellite dishes. They were everywhere, even in the desert. Many times we'd come upon a little nomad settlement with tents for houses and nothing but a couple animals and open land around them. Still, they were bristling with satellite dishes. Calling home. One night I was on an overwatch and things were quiet. Nights were normally slow in Baghdad. Insurgents usually wouldn't attack then because they knew we had the advantage with our technology, including our night vision gear and infrared sensors. So I thought I'd take a minute and call my wife back home just to tell I was thinking of her. I took our sat phone and dialed home. Most times when I talked to Taya, I'd tell her I was back at base, even though I was really on an overwatch or in the field somewhere. I didn't want to worry her. This night, for some reason, I told her what I was doing. "Is it all right to talk?" she asked. "Oh yeah, it's all good," I said. "There's nothing going on." Well, I got maybe another two or three sentences out of my mouth when someone started firing at the building from the street. "What's that?" she asked. "Oh, nothing," I said nonchalantly. Of course, the gunfire stoked up real loud as the words came out of my mouth. "Chris?" "Well, I think I'm going to get going now," I told her.
"Are you okay?"
"Oh, yeah, it's all good," I lied. "Nothing happening. Talk to you later." Just then, an RPG hit the outside wall right near me. Some of the building smacked into my face, giving me a couple of beauty marks and temporary tattoos courtesy of the insurgency. I dropped the phone and started returning fire. I spotted the guys down the street and popped one or two. The snipers who were with me downed a bunch more before the rest got the hell out of there. Fight over, I grabbed up the phone. The batteries had run out, so I couldn't call back. Things got busy for a few days, and it wasn't until two or three days later when I finally got a chance to call Taya and see how she was. She started crying as soon as she answered the phone. It turned out I hadn't actually ended the call before I put the phone down. She'd heard the whole gunfight, complete with shots and curses, before the batteries had finally run out, which, of course, happened all of a sudden, adding to the anxiety. I tried to calm her down, but I doubt what I said really eased her mind. She was always a good sport, always insisting that I didn't have to hide things from her. She claimed her imagination was a lot worse than anything that really could happen to me. I don't know about that. I made a few other calls home during lulls and battles during my deployments. The overall pace of the action was so intense and continuous that there weren't many alternatives. Waiting until I got back to our camp might mean waiting for a week or more, and while I'd call then, too, if I could, it wasn't always possible. And I got used to the battles. Getting shot at was just part of the job. RPG round, just another day at the office. My dad has a story about hearing from me at work one day when I hadn't a chance to call in a while. He picked up the phone and was surprised to hear my voice. He was even more surprised that I was whispering. "Chris, why is your voice so hushed?" he asked. "I'm on an op, Dad. I don't want them to know where I'm at." "Oh," he answered, a little shaken. I doubt I was actually close enough for the enemy to hear anything, but my father swears that a few seconds later there were gunshots in the background. "Gotta go," I said before he had a chance to find out what the sound was. "I'll get back to you." According to my father, I called back 2 days later to apologize for hanging up so abruptly. When he asked if he had overheard a start of a firefight, I changed the subject. Building my rep. My knees were still hurting from being pinned under rubble back in Fallujah. I tried to get cortisone shots, but couldn't. I didn't want to push too hard. I was afraid of getting pulled out because of my injury. Every once in a while, I took some Motrin and iced them down. That was about it. In battle, of course, I was fine. When your adrenaline is pumped, you don't feel anything. Even with the pain, I loved what I was doing. Maybe war isn't really fun, but I certainly was enjoying it. It suited me. By this time, I had a bit of a reputation as a sniper. I had a lot of confirmed kills. It was now a very good number for such a short period, or any period, really. Except for the team guys, people didn't really know my name and face, but there were rumors around, and my stay here added to my reputation, such as it was. It seemed like everywhere I set up, I'd get a target. This started to piss off some of the other snipers, who could spend whole shifts and even days without seeing anybody, let alone an insurgent. One day, Smurf, a fellow SEAL, started following me around as we went into an apartment. "Where are you setting up?" he asked. I looked around and found a place I thought looked good. "Right there," I told him. "Good. Get the hell out of here. I'm taking this spot." "Hey, you take it," I told him. I went off and found another spot, and promptly got a kill from there. For a while, it didn't seem to matter what I did. Things would happen in front of me. I wasn't inventing the incidents. I had witnesses for all my shots. Maybe I saw a little farther. Maybe I anticipated trouble better than other people. Or, most likely, I was just lucky. Assuming being a target for people who want to kill you can be considered luck. One time we were in a house on Haifa Street where we had so many snipers that the only possible place to shoot from was a tiny window above a toilet. I had to actually stand up the whole time. I still got 2 kills. I was just one lucky motherfucker. One day we got intel that the insurgents were using a cemetery at the edge of town near Camp Independence at the airport to cache weapons and launch attacks. The only way I could get a view of the place was to climb up on this tall, tall crane. Once at the top, I then had to go out on a thin mesh platform. I don't know how high I went. I don't want to know. Heights are not my favorite thing. It makes my balls go in my throat just thinking about it. The crane did give me a decent view of the cemetery, which was about 800 yards away. I never took a shot from there. I never saw anything aside from mourners and funerals, but it was worth a try. Besides looking for people with IEDs, we had to watch out for the bombs themselves. They were everywhere, occasionally even in the apartment buildings. One team narrowly escaped one afternoon, the explosives going off just after they collapsed down and left the building. The guard was using Bradleys to get around. The Bradley looks a bit like a tank, since it has a turret and gun on top, but it's actually a personnel carrier and scout vehicle, depending on its configuration. I believe it's made to fit 6 people inside. We would try and cram 8 or 10 in. It was hot, muggy, and claustrophobic. Unless you were sitting by the ramp, you couldn't see anything. You kind of sucked it up and waited to get wherever it was you were going. One day the Bradleys picked us up from a sniper op. We had just turned off Haifa onto one of the side streets, and all of a sudden, blam! We'd been hit by a massive IED. The back of the vehicle lifted up and slammed back down, the inside filled with smoke. I could see the guy across from me moving his mouth, but I couldn't hear a word. The blast had blown out my ears. The next thing I knew, the Bradley started moving again. That was one tough vehicle. Back at the base, the commander kind of shrugged it off. Didn't even knock the tracks off, he said. He almost sounded disappointed. It's a cliche, but it's true. You form tight friendships in war, and then suddenly circumstances change. I became close friends with two guys in the guard unit, real good friends. I trusted them with my life. Today I couldn't tell you their names if my life depended on it, and I'm not even sure that I can describe them in a way that would show you why they were special. Me and the boys from Arkansas seemed to get along real well together, maybe because we were all just country boys. Well, they were hillbillies. You got your regular redneck like me, then you got your hillbilly, who's a whole sight different animal. Onward. The elections came and went. The media back in the States made a big thing of the Iraqi government elections, but it was a non-event for me. I wasn't even out that day. I caught it on TV. I never really believed the Iraqis would turn the country into a truly functioning democracy, but I thought at one point that there was a chance. I don't know that I believe that now. It's a pretty corrupt place. But I didn't risk my life to bring democracy to Iraq. I risked my life for my buddies, to protect my friends and fellow countrymen. I went to war for my country, not Iraq. My country sent me out there so that bullshit wouldn't make its way back to our shores. I never once fought for the Iraqis. I couldn't give a flying fuck about them. A short while after the election, I was sent back to my SEAL platoon. Our time in Iraq was growing short, and I was starting to look forward to going home. Being at camp in Baghdad meant I had my own little room. My personal gear filled 4 or 5 cruise boxes, 2 big Stanley roller boxes, and assorted rucks. Cruise boxes are the modern equivalent of footlockers. They're waterproof and roughly 3 feet long. On deployment, we pack heavy. I also had a TV set. All the latest movies were on pirated DVDs selling at Baghdad street stands for $5. I bought a box set of James Bond movies, some Clint Eastwood, John Wayne. I love John Wayne. I love his cowboy movies especially, which makes sense, I guess. Rio Bravo may be my favorite. Besides movies, I spent a bit of time playing computer games. Command and Conquer became a personal favorite. Smurf had a PlayStation, and we started getting into playing Tiger Woods. I kicked his butt. DAs, helos, and heights. With Baghdad settling down, at least for the moment, the headshed decided they wanted to open up a SEAL base in Habaniya. Habaniya is 12 miles to the east of Fallujah in Anbar province. It wasn't quite the hotbed of the insurgency that Fallujah had been, but it wasn't San Diego either. This is the area where, before the first Gulf War, Saddam built chemical plants devoted to manufacturing weapons of mass destruction, such as nerve gas and other chemical agents. There weren't a lot of American supporters out there. There was a U.S. Army base, though, run by the famous 506th Regiment, the Band of Brothers. They'd just come over from Korea and, to be polite, had no fucking clue what Iraq was all about. I suppose everybody's got to learn the hard way. Habaniya turned out to be a real pain in the ass. We'd been given an abandoned building, but it was nowhere near adequate for what we needed. We had to build a TOC, a Tactical Operations Command, to house all the computers and comm gear that helped support us during our missions. Our morale sunk. We weren't doing anything useful for the war. We were working as carpenters. It's an honorable profession, but it's not ours. Taya. It was on this deployment that the medical doctors did a test and, for some reason, thought Chris had TB. The doctors told him he would eventually die of the disease. I remember talking to him right after he got the news. He was fatalistic about it. He'd already accepted that he was going to die, and he wanted to do it there, not at home from a disease he couldn't fight with a gun or his fists. It doesn't matter, he told me. I'll die, and you'll find someone else. People die out here all the time. Their wives go on and find someone else. I tried to explain to him that he was irreplaceable to me. When that didn't seem to faze him, I tried another equally valid point. But you've got our son, I told him. So what? You'll find someone else, and that guy will raise him. I think he was seeing death so often that he started to believe people were replaceable. It broke my heart. He truly believed that. I still hate to think that. He thought dying on the battlefield was the greatest. I tried to tell him differently, but he didn't believe it. They redid the tests, and Chris was cleared, but his attitude about death stayed. Once the camp was settled, we started doing DAs. We'd be given the name and location of a suspected insurgent, hit his house at night, then come back and deposit him and whatever evidence we gathered at the DIF, detention and interrogation facility, your basic jail. We'd take pictures along the way. We weren't sightseeing. We were covering our butts, and more important, those of our commanders. The pictures proved we hadn't beaten the crap out of him. Most of these ops were routine, without much trouble, and almost never any resistance. One night, though, one of our guys went into a house where a rather portly Iraqi decided he didn't want to come along nicely. He started to tussle. Now, from our perspective, our brother SEAL was getting the shit kicked out of him. According to the SEAL in question, he had actually slipped and was in no need of assistance. I guess you can interpret it any way you want. We all rushed in and grabbed the fatso before he could do much harm. Our friend got ribbed about his fall for a while. On most of these missions, we had photos of the person we were supposed to get. In that case, the rest of the intelligence tended to be pretty accurate. The guy was almost always where he was supposed to be, and things pretty much followed the outline we had drawn up. But some cases didn't go so smoothly. We began realizing that if we didn't have a photo, the intelligence was suspect. Knowing that the Americans would bring a suspect in, people were using tips to settle grievances or feuds. They'd talk to the Army or some other authority, making claims about a person helping the insurgency or committing some other crime. It sucked for the person we arrested, but I didn't get all that worked up about it. It was just one more example of how screwed up the country was. Second guest. One day the Army asked for a sniper overwatch for a 506th convoy that was coming into base. I went out with a small team and we took down a 3- or 4-story building. I set up in the top floor and started watching the area. Pretty soon the convoy headed down the road. As I was watching the area, a man came out of a building near the road and began maneuvering in the direction the convoy was going to take. He had an AK. I shot him. He went down. The convoy continued through. A bunch of other Iraqis came out and gathered around the guy I'd shot, but nobody that I could see made any threatening motions toward the convoy or looked to be in a position to attack it, so I didn't fire. A few minutes later, I heard on the radio that the Army is sending a unit out to investigate why I shot him. Huh? I'd already told the Army command on the radio what had happened, but I got back on the radio and repeated it. I was surprised. They didn't believe me. A tank commander came out and interviewed the dead man's wife. She told them her husband was on his way to the mosque carrying a Quran. Uh-huh. The story was ridiculous, but the officer, whom I'm guessing hadn't been in Iraq very long, didn't believe me. The soldiers began to look around for the rifle, but by that time so many people had been in the area that it was long gone. The tank commander pointed out my position. Did it come from there? Yes, yes, said the woman, who, of course, had no idea where the shot had come from since she hadn't been anywhere nearby. I know he's Army because he's wearing an Army uniform. Now, I was 2 rooms deep with a screen in front of me, wearing a gray jacket over my SEAL camis. Maybe she hallucinated in her grief, or maybe she just said whatever she thought would give me grief. We were recalled to base and the entire platoon put on stand down. I was told I was not operationally available. I was confined to base while the 506th investigated the incident further. The colonel wanted to interview me. My officer came with me. We were all pissed. The ROEs had been followed. I had plenty of witnesses. It was the Army investigators who had screwed up. I had trouble holding my tongue. At one point, I told the Army colonel, I don't shoot people with Qurans. I'd like to, but I don't. I guess I was a little hot. Well, after 3 days and God only knows how much other investigation, he finally realized that it had been a good kill and dropped the matter. But when the regiment asked for more overwatches, we told him to fuck off. Anytime I shoot someone, you're just going to try and have me executed, I said. No way. We were heading home in 2 weeks anyway. Aside from a few more DAs, I spent most of that time playing video games, watching porn, and working out. I finished that deployment with a substantial number of confirmed sniper kills. Most happened in Fallujah. Carlos Norman Hathcock II, the most famous member of the sniping profession, a true legend and a man whom I look up to, tallied 93 confirmed kills during his 3 years of tours in the Vietnam War. I'm not saying I was in his class. In my mind, he was and always will be the greatest sniper ever. But in sheer numbers, at least, I was close enough for people to start thinking I'd done a hell of a job. 8. Family conflicts. Taya. We went out to the tarmac to wait for the plane when it came in. There were a few wives and children. I came out with our baby and I felt so excited. I was over the moon. I remember turning to one of the women I was with and saying, "Isn't this great? Isn't this exciting? I can't stand it." She said, "Eh." I thought to myself, "Well, maybe I'm still new to it." Later on, she and her husband, Nasil and Chris's platoon, got divorced. Bonding. I left the States some 7 months before, only 10 days after my son was born. I loved him, but as I mentioned earlier, we really hadn't had a chance to bond. Newborns are just a bundle of needs. Feed him, clean him, get him to rest. Now he had a personality. He was crawling. He was more of a person. I'd see him growing up in the photos Taya had sent me, but this was more intense. He was my son. We'd lie on the floor in our pajamas and play together. He'd crawl all over me and I'd boost him up and carry him all around. Even the simplest things, like him touching my face, were a joy. But the transition from war to home was still a shock. One day we'd been fighting. The next, we'd crossed the river to Al Takadam Air Base, known to us as TQ, and started back for the States. War one day, peace the next. Every time you come home, it's weird, especially in California. The simplest things can upset you. Take traffic. You're driving on the road, everything's crowded, it's craziness. You're still thinking IEDs. You see a piece of trash and you swerve. You drive aggressively toward other drivers, because that's the way you do it in Iraq. I would shut myself in for about a week. I think that's where Taya and I started having problems. Being parents for the first time, we had the disagreements everyone has about children. Co-sleeping, for instance. Taya had my son sleep with her in a co-sleeper in the bed while I was gone. When I came home, I wanted to change that. We disagreed quite a bit on that. I thought he should be in his own crib in his own room. Taya saw it as depriving her of her closeness with him. She thought we should transition him gradually. That wasn't how I saw it at all. I felt children should sleep in their own beds and rooms. I know now that issues like that are common, but there was added stress. She'd been raising him completely on her own for months now, and I was intruding on her routines and ways of doing things. They were incredibly close, which I thought was great, but I wanted to be with him too. I wasn't trying to come between them, just add myself back into the family. As it happened, none of that was a big deal for my son. He slept just fine, and he still has a very special relationship with his mom. Life at home had its interesting moments, though the drama was very different. Our neighbors and close friends were completely respectful of my need for time to decompress. Once that was over, they put together a little welcome home barbecue. They'd all been great while I was gone. The people across the street arranged to have someone cut our grass, which was huge to us financially, and helped Taya with the heavy load she carried while I was gone. It seemed like a little thing, but it was big to me. Now that I was home, of course, it was my job to take care of things like that. We had a small, itty-bitty backyard. It took all of 5 minutes to cut the grass back there. But on one side of the yard were climbing roses that climbed up these potato bush trees we had. The bushes had little purple flowers on them year-round. The combination looked really pretty, but the roses had thorns in them that could pierce an armored vest. Every time I'd mow the yard and come around the corner, I'd get snagged by them. One day those roses just went too far, tearing at my side. I decided to take care of them once and for all. I picked up my lawnmower, held it up about chest high, and trimmed those mothers, the roses and the trees, down.
"What? Are you kidding me?"
yelled Taya. "Are you trimming the bushes with the lawnmower?" Hey, it worked. They never snagged me again. I did do some genuinely goofy stuff. Having fun and making other people smile and laugh has always been something I like to do. One day I saw our backyard neighbor through our kitchen window, so I stood on a chair and knocked on the window to get her attention. I proceeded to moon her. Her husband happened to be a Navy pilot, so I'm sure she was familiar with such things. Taya rolled her eyes. She was amused, I think, though she wouldn't admit it.
"Who does that?"
she said to me.
"She laughed, didn't she?" I said.
"You are 30 years old," she said.
"Who does that?"
There's a side of me that loves to pull pranks on people, to get them to laugh. You can't do regular stuff. I want them to have a good time. Belly laughs. The more extreme, the better. April Fool's Day is a particularly tough time for my family and friends, though more because of Taya's pranks than my own. I guess we both like to have a good laugh. On the darker side, I was extremely hot-headed. I have always had a temper, even before becoming a SEAL, but it was more explosive now. If someone cut me off, not a very rare occurrence in California, I could get crazy. I might try and run them off the road, or even stop and whoop their ass. I had to work at calming down. Of course, having a reputation as a SEAL does have its advantages. At my sister-in-law's wedding, the preacher and I got to talking. At some point, she, the preacher was a lady, noticed a bulge in my jacket.
"You have a gun?" she asked.
"Yes, I do," I said, explaining that I was in the military. She may or may not have known that I was a SEAL. I didn't tell her, but word tends to get around. But when she was ready to start the ceremony and couldn't get anyone in the crowd to be quiet and get into place, she came over to me, patted me on the back, and said, "Can you get everyone to sit down?" "Yes, I can," I told her. I barely had to raise my voice to get that little ceremony going. Taya,
people talk about physical love and need when someone comes home from a long absence. "I want to rip your clothes off," that sort of thing. I felt that way in theory, but the reality was always a little different. I needed to get to know him again. It was strange. There's so much anticipation. You miss them so much when they deploy, and you want them to be home, but then when they are, things aren't perfect, and you feel as if they should be. Depending on the deployment and what I'd been through, I also had emotions ranging from sadness to anxiety to anger. When he came back after this deployment, I felt almost shy. I was a new mother and had been doing things on my own for months. We were both changing and growing in totally separate worlds. He had no first-hand knowledge of mine, and I had no first-hand knowledge of his. I also felt bad for Chris. He was wondering what was wrong. There was distance between us that neither one of us could really fix or even talk about. Breaking and entering. We had a long break from war, but we were busy the whole time, retraining and, in some cases, learning new skills. I went to a school run by FBI agents and CIA and NSA officers. They taught me how to do things like pick locks and steal cars. I loved it. The fact that it was in New Orleans didn't hurt either. Learning how to blend in and go undercover, I cultivated my inner jazz musician and grew a goatee. Lock picking was a revelation. We worked on a variety of locks. And by the end of the class, I don't think there was a lock that could have kept me or anyone else in our class at bay. Stealing cars was a little harder, but I got pretty good at that, too. We were trained to wear cameras and eavesdropping devices without getting caught. To prove that we could, we had to get the devices into a strip club and return with video evidence that we'd been there. The sacrifices you make for your country. I stole a car off Bourbon Street as part of my final. I had to put it back when we were done. As far as I know, the owner was none the wiser. Unfortunately, these are all perishable skills. I can still pick a lock, but it'll take me longer now.
I'll have to brush up if I ever decide to go crooked. Among our more normal rotations was recertification class for parachuting. Jumping out of planes, or I should say, landing safely after jumping out of planes, is an important skill, but it's a dangerous one. Hell, I've heard it said the Army figures in combat, if they get 70% of the guys in a unit to land safely enough to rally and fight, they're doing well. Think about that. 1,000 guys, 300 don't make it. Not a big deal to the Army. Okay. I went to Fort Benning to train with the Army right after I first became a SEAL. I guess I should have realized what I was in for on the first day of school when a soldier just ahead of me refused to jump. We all stood there waiting and thinking while the instructors tended to him. I'm afraid of heights as it is, and this didn't build my confidence. Holy shit, I wondered. What's he seeing that I'm not? Being a SEAL, I had to make a good showing, or at least not look like a wimp. Once he was taken out of the way, I closed my eyes and plunged ahead. It was on one of those early static jumps, jumps where the cord is automatically pulled for you, a procedure usually used for beginners, that I made the mistake of looking up to check my canopy as I left the plane. They tell you not to do that. I was wondering why when the chute deployed. My tremendous sense of relief that I had a canopy and wasn't going to die was mitigated by the rope burns on both sides of my face. The reason they tell you not to look up is so that you don't get hit by the risers as they fly by your head when the chute opens. Some things you learn the hard way. And then there are night jumps. You can't see the land coming. You know you have to roll into PLFs, parachute landing falls, but when? I tell myself the first time I feel something, I'm going to roll. The first time? The first? I think I banged my head every time I jumped at night. I will say I preferred free fall to static jumping. I'm not saying I enjoyed it, just that I liked it a lot better. Kind of like picking the firing squad over being hanged. In free fall, you come down a lot slower and had much more control. I know there are all these videos of people doing stunts and tricks, having a grand old time doing halo, high altitude, low opening jumps. There are none of me. I watch my wrist altimeter the whole time. That cord is pulled the split second I hit the right altitude. On my last jump with the Army, another jumper came right under me as we descended. When that happens, the lower canopy can steal the air beneath you. The result is, you fall faster than you were falling. The consequences can be pretty dramatic, depending on the circumstances. In this case, I was 70 feet from the ground. I ended up falling from there, and having a couple of tree branches and the ground beat the crap out of me. I walked away with some bumps and bruises and a few broken ribs. Fortunately, it was the last jump of the school. My ribs and I soldiered on, glad to be done. Of course, as bad as parachuting is, it beats spy rigging. Spy rigging may look cool, but one wrong move and you can spin off in Mexico, or Canada, or maybe even China. Strangely, though, I like helos. During this workup, my platoon worked with MH-6 Little Birds. Those are very small, very fast scout and attack helicopters adapted for special operations work. Our versions had benches fitted to each side. Three SEALs can sit on each bench. I loved them. True, I was scared to death getting on the damn thing, but once the pilot took off and we were in the air, I was hooked. It was a tremendous adrenaline rush. You're low and fast. It's awesome. The momentum of the aircraft keeps you in place. You don't even feel any wind buffeting. And hell, if you fall, you'll never feel a thing. The pilots who commanded those aircraft are among the best in the world. They were all members of the 160th SOAR, the Special Operations Air Wing, hand-picked to work with spec warfare personnel. There's a difference, and it's noticeable. When you're fast roping from a chopper with a regular pilot, you may find yourself at the wrong altitude, too high for the rope to reach the ground. At that point, it's too late to do anything about it except grunt or groan as you hit the ground. A lot of pilots also have trouble holding station, staying put long enough for you to get in the right spot on the ground. Not so with the guys from SOAR. Right place, first time, every time. That rope drops, it's where it belongs. Marcus. The 4th of July 2005 was a beautiful California day. Perfect weather, not a cloud in the sky. My wife and I took our son and drove out to a friend's house in the foothills outside of town. There we spread a blanket and gathered in the tailgate of my Yukon to watch the fireworks put on at an Indian reservation in the valley. It was a perfect spot. We could see down as the fireworks came up to us, and the effect was spectacular. I've always loved celebrating the 4th of July. I love the symbolism, meaning of the day, and of course the fireworks and the barbecues. It's just a wonderful time. But that day, as I sat back and watched the red, white, and blue sparkles, sadness suddenly spread over me. I fell into a deep black hole. "This sucks," I muttered as the fireworks exploded. I wasn't critiquing the show. I had just realized that I might never see my friend Marcus Luttrell again. I hated to be unable to do anything to help my friend who was facing God only knew what kind of trouble. We'd gotten word a few days before that he was missing. I'd also heard through the SEAL grapevine that the three guys he was with were dead. They'd been ambushed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Surrounded by hundreds of Taliban fighters, they fought ferociously. Another 16 men in a rescue party were killed when the Chinook they were flying in was shot down. You can and should read the details in Marcus's book, Lone Survivor. To that point, losing a friend in combat seemed, if not impossible, at least distant and unlikely. It may seem strange to say, given everything I'd been through, but at that point we were feeling pretty sure of ourselves. Cocky, maybe. You just get to a point where you think you're such a superior fighter that you can't be hurt. Our platoon had come through the war without any serious injuries. In some respects, training seemed more dangerous. There had been accidents in training. Not long before, we were doing ship takedowns when one of our platoon members fell while going up the side. He landed on two other guys in the boat. All three had to go to the hospital. One of the men he landed on broke his neck. We don't focus on the dangers. The families, though, are a different story. They're always very aware of the dangers. The wives and girlfriends often take turns sitting in the hospital with the families of people who were injured. Inevitably, they realize they could be sitting there for their own husband or boyfriend. I remained torn up about Marcus for the rest of the night in my own private black hole. I stayed there for a few days. Work, of course, continued. One day, my chief popped his head into the room and signaled me to join him outside. "Hey, they found Marcus," he said as soon as we were alone. "Great." "He's fucked up." "So what? He's going to make it." Anyone who knew Marcus knew that was true. The man cannot be kept down. "Yeah, you're right," said my chief. "But he's pretty tore up, beat up. It'll be hard." It was hard, but Marcus was up to it. In fact, despite health issues that continue to dog him, he would deploy again not long after leaving the hospital. Expert, so-called. Because of what I'd done in Fallujah, I was pulled out a few times to talk to headshed types about how I thought snipers should be deployed. I was now a subject matter expert, an SME in militaries. I hated it. Some people might find it flattering to be talking to a bunch of high-ranking officers, but I just wanted to do my job. It was torture sitting in the room, trying to explain what the war was like. They'd ask me questions like, "What kind of gear should we have?" Not unreasonable, I guess, but all I could think of was, "God, you guys are really all pretty stupid. This is basic stuff you should have figured out long ago." I would tell them what I thought, how we should train up snipers, how we should use them. I suggested more training about urban overwatches and creating hides in buildings, things that I'd learned more or less as I went. I gave them ideas about sending snipers into an area before the assault so they could provide intel to the assault teams before they arrived. I made suggestions on how to make snipers more active and aggressive. I suggested that snipers take shots over the heads of an assault team during training so the teams could get used to working with them. I told the brass about gear issues, the dust cover of the M11, for example, and suppressors that jiggled at the end of the barrel, hurting the accuracy of the rifle. It was all extremely obvious to me, but not to them. Asked for my opinion, I'd give it, but most times they didn't really want it. They wanted me to validate some decision they'd already made or some thought they'd already had. I'd tell them about a given piece of gear I thought we should have. They'd answer that they'd already bought 1,000 of something else. I'd offer them a strategy I'd used successfully in Fallujah. They'd quote me chapter and verse on why it wouldn't work. Taya. We had a lot of confrontations while he was home. His enlistment was coming up, and I didn't want him to re-up. I felt he had done his duty to the country, even more than anyone could ask, and I felt that we needed him. I've always believed that your responsibility is to God, family, and country, in that order. He disagreed. He put country ahead of family. And yet, he wasn't completely obstinate. He always said, "If you tell me not to re-enlist, I won't." But I couldn't do that. I told him, "I can't tell you what to do. You'll just hate me and resent me all your life." "But I will tell you this," I said. "If you do re-enlist, then I know exactly where we stand. It will change things. I won't want it to, but I know in my heart it will." When he re-enlisted anyway, I thought, "Okay, now I know. Being a SEAL is more important to him than being a father or a husband." New guys. While we were training up for our next deployment, the platoon got a group of new guys. A few of them stood out, Dauber and Tommy, for example, who were both snipers and corpsmen. But I think the new guy who made the biggest impression was Ryan Jobe, and the reason was that he did not look like a SEAL. On the contrary, Ryan looked like a big lump. I was floored that they let this guy come to the team. Here we all were, buff, in great shape, and here was a round, soft-looking guy. I went up to Ryan and got in his face. "What's your problem, fat fuck? You think you're a SEAL?" We all gave him shit. One of my officers, we'll call him LT, knew him from buds and stuck up for him, but LT was a new guy himself, so that didn't carry too much weight. Being a new guy, we would have beat Ryan's ass anyway, but his weight made things a lot worse for him. We actively tried to make him quit. But Ryan wasn't a quitter. You couldn't compare his determination with anyone else's. That kid started working out like a maniac. He lost weight and got into better shape. More importantly, anything we told him to do, he did. He was such a hard worker, so sincere, and so damn funny, that at some point we just went, "I love you. You are the man." Because no matter how he looked, he truly was a SEAL, and a damn good one. We tested him, believe me. We'd find the biggest man in the platoon and make him carry him. He did it. We'd have him take the hardest jobs in training. He did them without complaint, and he'd crack us up in the process. He had these great facial expressions. He could point his upper lip, screw his eyes around, and then twist in a certain way, and you'd lose it. Naturally, this ability led to a certain amount of fun, for us at least. One time we told him to go do the face to our chief. "B-but," he stammered. "Do it," I told him. "Go get in his face. You're the new guy. Do it." He did. Thinking Ryan was trying to be a jerk, the chief grabbed him by the throat and tossed him to the ground. That only encouraged us. Ryan had to show the face a lot. Every time he'd go and get his ass beat. Finally, we had him do it to one of our officers, a huge guy. Definitely not someone to be messed with, even by another SEAL. "Go do it to him," one of us said. "Oh, God, no," he protested. "If you don't do it right now, we're going to choke you out," I warned. "Can you please just choke me out right now?" "Go do it," we all said. He went and did it to the officer. He reacted about how you would expect. After a while, Ryan tried to tap out. "There's no tapping out," he snarled, continuing his pounding. Ryan survived, but that was the last time we made him do the face. Everybody got hazed when they joined the platoon. We were equal opportunity ball busters. Officers got it just as bad as enlisted men. At the time, new guys didn't receive their tridents and thus weren't really SEALs until after they had passed a series of tests with the team. We had our own little ritual that involved a mock boxing match against their whole platoon. Each new guy had to go through 3 rounds. Once you're knocked down, that's a round, before being formally pinned and welcomed to the Brotherhood. I was Ryan's safety officer, making sure he didn't get too busted up. He had a head guard and everyone wore boxing gloves, but the hazing can get kind of enthusiastic, and the safety officer is there to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. Ryan wasn't satisfied with 3 rounds. He wanted more. I think he thought if he fought long enough, he'd beat them all. Not that he lasted too much longer. I had warned him that I was his safety, and whatever he did, he was not to hit me. In the confusion of his head being bounced off the platoon's gloves, he swung and hit me. I did what I had to do. Mark Lee. With our deployment rapidly approaching, our platoon was beefed up. Command brought a young SEAL named Mark Lee over from another unit to help round us out. He immediately fit in. Mark was an athletic guy, in some ways exactly the sort of tough physical specimen you'd expect to be a SEAL. Before joining the Navy, he had played soccer well enough to be given a tryout with a professional team, and may very well have been pro if a leg injury hadn't cut his career short. But there was a lot more to Mark than just physical prowess. He'd studied for the ministry, and while he left because of what he saw as hypocrisy among the seminary students, he was still very religious. Later on, during our deployment, he led a small group in prayer before every op. As you'd expect, he was very knowledgeable about the Bible and religion in general. He didn't push it on you, but if you needed or wanted to talk about faith or God, he was always willing. Not that he was a saint, or even above the horseplay that is part of being a SEAL. Soon after he joined us, we went on a training mission to Nevada. At the end of the day, a group of us piled into a 4-door truck and headed back to the base to get to bed. Mark was in the back with me and a SEAL we'll call Bob. For some reason, Bob and I started talking about being choked out. With new guy enthusiasm, and maybe naivete, Mark said, "I've never been choked out." "Excuse me," I said, leaning over to get a look at this virgin. "Being choked out is a mandatory SEAL occupation." Mark looked at me. I looked at him. "Bring it on," he said. As Bob leaned over, I dove and choked Mark out. My work completed, I leaned back. "You mother," said Bob, straightening. "I wanted to do it." "I thought you were leaning over to let me get him," I told him. "Hell no, I was just handing my watch up front so it wouldn't get broken." "Well, okay," I said. "He'll wake up, then you get him." He did. I think half the platoon had a shot at him before the night was out. Mark took it well. Of course, as a new guy, he had no choice. Command. I loved our new CO. He was outstanding, aggressive, and stayed out of our hair. He not only knew each one of us by name and face, he knew our wives and girlfriends. He took it personally when he lost people, and yet was able to stay aggressive at the same time. He never held us back in training, and, in fact, approved extra training for snipers. My command master chief, whom I'll call Primo, was another top-notch commander. He didn't give a flying fuck about promotions, about looking good or covering his butt. He was all about successful missions and getting the job done. And he was a Texan. As you can tell, I'm a little partial, which meant he was a badass. His briefings always started the same way. "What are you sons of bitches doing?" he'd snarl. "Are you going to get out there and kick some ass?" Primo was all about getting into battle. He knew what SEALs are supposed to do, and he wanted us to do it. He was also a good old boy off the battlefield. You always have team guys getting in trouble during off time and training. Bar fights are a big problem. I remember him pulling us aside when he came on. "Listen, I know you're going to get into fights," he told us, "so here's what you do. You hit fast, you hit hard, and you run. If you don't get caught, I don't care, because when you get caught is when I have to get involved." I took that advice to heart. though it wasn't always possible to follow. Maybe because he was from Texas, or maybe because he had the soul of a brawler himself, he took a liking to me and another Texan, whom we called Pepper. We became his